Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is U.S. v. Gallo-Moreno.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Linda Annoy, and I represent Defendant Appellant Arturo Gallo-Moreno. This case stems from the alleged participation of a man named Fernando Carrion in a drug conspiracy in 1994. And the issue in this case is whether the defendant is Fernando. At trial, the court admitted and relied on voice identification testimony that was obtained at a critical stage of the proceedings without the presence of Mr. Gallo-Moreno's lawyer. And that voice identification was procured by unduly suggestive and unnecessary procedures and is unreliable under a totality of the circumstances. In addition, the court erred in admitting and relying on other acts evidence regarding an uncharged 1997 drug transaction that was unrelated to the 1994 transaction and was not probative to the issue of identity. I'd like to first turn to the issue about why Agent Tovar's testimony about the 1997 voice identification should have been excluded. Agent Tovar, just to give you a little background, was the agent involved in the 1994 drug conspiracy involving Fernando. And he had an opportunity to briefly speak with Fernando for approximately a half hour, about eight conversations or so. 3 years later, in 1997, Tovar is told that Fernando is in custody, and he is instructed to prepare to meet the defendant by listening to some tapes of Fernando's voice from 1994. He reviews those tapes for about 4 to 6 hours, and the next day, Tovar goes to retrieve the defendant from custody. This was a show-up identification. Unlike the typical show-up identification where it's merely implied that this is the man, in this instance, it was expressed. He was told that Fernando was in custody, and then he went to go and retrieve the defendant. At this point, Tovar knows that voice identification is a key issue in this case because he spent the night before preparing. He engages the defendant in a conversation without the presence of Mr. Gallo-Moreno's counsel. That voice identification
testimony.
What would
counsel have done to assist his defendant, his client?
There are a number of things that counsel can do in those suggestive face-to-face encounters. Courts have recognized that there's just inherent suggestiveness in meeting, confronting the witness and the defendant face-to-face. And the counsel could have stepped in to stop some of the suggestiveness, could have insisted that before Tovar listened to the voice of the defendant that he had a voice array or that there was a voice lineup. And even if there wasn't a voice array, counsel's presence is required so that there's an effective cross-examination at the trial, because the defendant might not be able to unpack all of the inherent suggestiveness. Despite the fact that counsel wasn't present, Tovar engages in conversation, and he says he immediately recognizes Mr. Gallo-Moreno's voice as that of Fernando's. That testimony regarding that identification should have been excluded per se.
Well, the lawyer was going to be present and was unable to be there, as I understand.
The lawyer was going to be present, and he would have been present for the voice exemplars. But there was no discussion about...
There was never any suggestion that we were going to have different, like you said a voice lineup or something like that. That was never contemplated by
There's no evidence in the record that counsel thought that what would happen was there would be a Tovar would be present listening to the defendant's voice without a lineup. Him seeing Gallo-Moreno speak was problematic. It should have been just listening to the voice on tapes. But even if counsel would have had Tovar in the same room as the identification as Mr. Gallo-Moreno, it's still problematic because excuse me, I'm sorry.
Take your time.
It's problematic because the face-to-face show-up is suggested, and that's why counsel needs to be present. Here, there wasn't a waiver. There was no sense of the defendant saying that he didn't want his counsel present. In fact, the facts sort of belie that because Tovar didn't know that the defendant knew how to speak English, and the minute that when he ran into somebody else that was speaking English, he said to him, this is Fernando, and Mr. Guy Moreno stops talking at that moment, indicating that something was going on there that he didn't like, that it was a problem.
Counsel was present at the subsequent ID procedure involving the voice exemplars.
He was, but the problem is at that point, it's already tainted. The courts have said that once a witness makes an identification, it's very unlikely for them to change their mind. The identification becomes crystallized in their mind. So at that point with the exemplars, even though counsel is present, it doesn't erase the problem with the initial one. In fact, Tovar is likely to again identify him based on that first identification. So even if there would have been a voice array at the second one, at the March 2001 identification, it's still problematic because even at that point, he's already got Mr. Guy Moreno's voice in his mind as being Fernando. Did that answer your question?
It did.
A wholly separate grounds for excluding that evidence is also the fact that it was obtained by unduly suggested procedures such that it's unreliable under a totality of the circumstances. It was a show-up identification. All that the government would have had to do was make sure that that Tovar didn't encounter the defendant in that face-to-face conversation. That is inherently suggestive. Show-up identifications have been inherently suggestive.
Well, is that really the rule of law anymore? That was the rule of Stovall, but after Neal versus Biggers and Manson versus Brathwaite, I'm not so sure that that's a correct proposition, that all show-ups are inherently suggestive. There's no per se rule of exclusion.
You're right. I misspoke.
I know some of our cases still hold that, but I'm not sure that's correct.
And I think the distinction is if there are extraordinary circumstances compelling it, then they are okay.
You know, I'm going to quarrel with you on that, too, because that's the rule of Stovall, which focused on the necessity of using the procedure. And Neal versus Biggers and Manson versus Brathwaite significantly retrench from that position and focus less on the circumstances, the necessity of using a show-up versus some other ID procedure, and use reliability as the touchstone, because what we're talking about, of course, are trial rights here.
You're correct. Even if not all show-ups are deemed suggestive, this one was, under the circumstances of this case. And it can't be deemed reliable, notwithstanding the suggestiveness of this case. In this case, Tovar was told this is Fernando, and he was prepared to make an identification that day. And I think that's the distinction. The identification process had already begun. He'd already listened to the tapes. He was ready to prepped to make an identification, and I think that's the real problem with this case. So when he speaks to the defendant, he's primed to reach that result. So I think the procedures in this case are particularly suggestive.
Had he been told that Varela, the confidential informant, had ID'd Fernando?
The record doesn't specifically say that he had been told that, but he was with Agent Olin, and Agent Olin is, at the time he met, he talked with Mr. Guy Moreno, and Agent Olin was a man, the agent that had had a conversation with the paid confidential informant Varela that linked Mr. Guy Moreno to Fernando's arrest warrant. So the man he was with, the agent he was with, actually believed Mr. Guy Moreno to be Fernando as well. So all of those circumstances really lead Tovar to identify Mr. Guy Moreno as Fernando. And then when we look at the reliability, because as you said, that's the linchpin of the analysis, one can't say that the identification is reliable. You know, one factor the courts have looked at is certainty, and here Tovar was certain, but when that's just as likely to be a product of the unduly suggestive procedure as it is to be any independent recollection, that factor is irrelevant. There's also the factor about attention and accuracy. Here, Tovar never made a description of Fernando's voice after hearing it in 1994 and prior to hearing Mr. Gaio Moreno's voice. So there's no way to check the accuracy of his identification. There's no evidence that he paid sufficient attention such that this court can be certain that the identification is reliable, notwithstanding the suggestive procedures.
Are you familiar with the Infelice case? United States versus Infelice, Infelice.
I'm not off the top of my head.
It involves voice exemplars and the Sixth Amendment argument that you're making here. It's a 1974 case from this circuit.
Is there a question I could maybe answer for you?
Well, it seems to control here. It's a case where an agent IDs the defendant's voice from a voice exemplar after a face-to-face confrontation with the defendant in which the agent advises the defendant of his constitutional rights and hears him speak and makes a contemporaneous identification.
The difference there is if the voice identification was based on the tape recording versus the face-to-face confrontation. It's the confrontation of the witness and the defendant that is problematic, that is inherently suggestive. If we're just making the identification based on tapes, you don't have the same situation. It's like eyewitness testimony in the sense that if there's a lineup or if you see the accused in a one-on-one confrontation, you need counsel present. If you see a photographic display, counsel's not required to be at that identification procedure. So the difference here is that if the identification in that case, and I apologize for not being more familiar with that case, but if it was made based on exemplars or tapes, then counsel wouldn't have needed to be present. But here, Tovar identifies them during that very suggestive confrontation that happens when he retrieves the defendant from custody.
See, what bothers me here is it seems to me you argue that it's very suggestive because Tovar came in with preparation. He had listened to all these tapes of what occurred in 94. But that seems to make his identification more reliable. If he had come in there cold, not having listened to anything, and just hears the defendant say a few words, that's the guy I talked to in 94, that would be less reliable. As I look at it,
I
listen to you talk for 4 hours and then went in the next room and heard you again, that would be, I could say that's you, I think.
I'd like to save some time for rebuttal, but I want to answer your question. I think it's worse in this case. It makes it worse in this case because now I know that I need to make an identification. So when I see the defendant in that face-to-face confrontation, I'm more susceptible to make an identification. I think it's different if you hear that voice and you have 4 to 6 hours of familiarity and then you're presented with an exemplar or a voice array, because now you have to go back to the 4 to 6 hours and try and really remember Fernando's voice and try and pick it out. But here, I think that makes it worse because it tells him that subconsciously or consciously that he needs to identify this man as Fernando. He knows everyone around him believes it's Fernando, and it's time for him to make that identification. And the 4 to 6 hours isn't so much time that his familiarity would completely make the suggestive procedure.
Does it make any difference if we're dealing with an agent rather than just a civilian witness?
No, I don't think it does, because they're as susceptible to those influences as any other witness.
Well, maybe. They're dealing with that sort of thing all along. Wouldn't that make a little difference?
But they deal with it a lot? Well, it makes the difference.
Professional law enforcement officer.
Then he should have known that counsel needed to be present. He should have recognized that his task was to identify the voice, so he knew the importance of the identification to the case. So I think that almost makes it more likely that he's going to identify the defendant as Fernando. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Kern?
May it please the Court, Hallie Gurn on behalf of the United States. In this situation, Agent Tovar's voice identification of the defendant was reliable. And we know it's reliable, as Judge Sykes has pointed out, from the Biggers five factors. These Biggers five factors require the opportunity to view the crime, the degree of attention, and the accuracy of a prior description, certainty, and time lapse. In this situation, Agent Tovar meets the majority of these circumstances from the fact that he took 4 to 6 hours to listen to a 30 minutes of recording the day before he then saw the defendant and heard his voice. So therefore, he had his attention focused. He knew that he was going to make the identification, that he was going to need to make an identification. And let me just point out something that that the appellant has said. He was meeting for the purpose of obtaining voice exemplars. This was not just that he was going to get this guy to try to trick him into some sort of conversation. He was bringing him over so that he could meet with counsel to hear voice exemplars, and that's why he was spending those 4 to 6 hours preparing.
Well, if that's the case, and I accept that it is, then why did you send the transactional case agent who was going to be the ID witness to transport the defendant from the jail? That makes no sense to me.
Your Honor,
you just invite these sorts of arguments.
Your Honor, I would actually offer to say that it doesn't make a difference if the agent is sent or not, and the reason why is because this is a voice exemplar, essentially. Whether or not he hears it in a recording, whether or not he hears it from the person himself, whether or not he hears it at the MCC or he hears it in an office, either way, that really doesn't affect the situation.
Right, but right to counsel has attached. We're post-indictment, post-arraignment. He's got a lawyer. The lawyer has asked to be present. And yet you send the transactional case agent to pick him up, even though that agent is going to be making the ID from the exemplars. I mean, you just invite this sort of argument that the contemporaneous ID that he makes in casual conversation with the prisoner while he's transporting him to give the voice exemplars is going to taint the subsequent ID.
I recognize, Your Honor, that that this was post-indictment and that the right to counsel attached, and certainly that he was, in fact, meeting his defense counsel to give these voice exemplars. However, because it's a voice exemplar, it's not a critical stage, even though it's post-indictment. There was no confrontation. There's really nothing that a defense attorney can do in that situation.
Well, the defense attorney could have told the defendant to keep his mouth shut until he got to the voice exemplar testing station, wherever he would be making the recording, and not give the case agent the opportunity to make a contemporaneous face-to-face ID based on hearing his voice.
I think there's two things that are important for this case. The first is that the case agent actually never saw Fernando in 1994. He only heard his voice. So the face-to-face encounter, it doesn't make any difference in terms of his recognition. But there was never any suggestion in the second issue is that there was never any suggestion brought up in the district court in any way by the defendant at the time of having a voice array ever done. It was always going to be voice exemplars. And since it was always going to be a voice exemplar, again, I would say that it makes no difference whether or not the agent hears the defendant's voice as a voice sample in person, in a recording, while making the voice exemplar. Either way, it's still simply the giving of a voice sample, and not a confrontation in any way, and not a situation involving a lineup.
Detective Tovar, or I guess he's not a detective, he's a DEA agent, was told not to talk to the defendant about the case, apparently. So there was some, at least, anticipation that there could be a problem.
Your Honor, you're right. That was referring to substantively, because counsel was already involved in the case and he already had a right to counsel. That's the type of issue where there would be a testimonial conversation that would relate to the substance of the case. So Agent Tovar was instructed very strongly not to talk to the defendant about the substance of the case. because of the Sixth Amendment, and the Supreme Court recognizes that sort of situation with its deliberate elicitation doctrine, where it discusses the fact that when you're talking about the substance of the case, there's a whole other standard that applies. And in addition, Your Honor, I wanted to point out that there is a Fourth Circuit case that really is on all fours here with regard to the right to counsel. It's United States v. Oriki, 57 F3D 1290. And in that situation, again, it had to do with voice identifications, and the agent was actually escorting the defendant back and forth to various meetings with the defense counsel, as well as is hearing him in his testimony in a suppression hearing, and he identified the defendant's voice from these conversations, these informal conversations. And what the court there discussed was the fact that this identification was essentially a live voice exemplar where the right to counsel doesn't attach, much like giving a handwriting exemplar. And in fact, Gilbert v. California also discusses this idea that in an exemplar situation, and in Gilbert's it was handwriting, but the discussion in Gilbert's and dicta didn't limit it just to handwriting. It did discuss voice exemplars and body exemplars, that there is no right to counsel in that situation. And because this was a situation where the agent was simply hearing his voice and nothing more, the substance of that conversation didn't make a difference. And in fact, the agent was discussing very casual things, the earthquake in Mexico, how things were going, the weather, and not getting into the substance of the case. This isn't a circumstance that is considered a critical stage requiring the right to counsel and the right to the presence of counsel.
Well, would the analysis be different if this were a civilian witness, not a law enforcement witness? Would you have done a face-to-face show up prior to the voice exemplar?
Again, I would say that this wasn't a show-up. This was a logistical situation.
Well, that's the comparable analysis, because it's a face-to-face ID, right? One-on-one.
That's correct. And, I would argue the same thing. It doesn't make a difference. I think that, as Judge Kakini had pointed...
It doesn't make any difference at all? So you would do... if you were contemplating presenting a civilian eyewitness with tapes to make... of the defendant's voice exemplars, to make an ID or attempt an ID, that you would give the witness the opportunity beforehand or put the witness in a position of listening to the live voice of the defendant before having the witness listen to the tapes?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. I didn't realize that you were also talking about the fact that the witness would also be expected to make a...
Right. I'm just trying to put the ID witness in the same situation that our ID witness is in this case, but mm-hmm. Let's assume it's a civilian witness and not a law enforcement witness. I cannot imagine that you would do that.
I think that you're right in terms of the logistics of the situation, that it would be something that would be attempted to be avoided. I don't think that... Again, I think that ultimately it doesn't make a difference as applied here, because when you look at the reliability issues, as you discussed, it overcomes all issues regarding the unduly suggestive nature of the show-up and or the voice exemplar. And I think that, you know, as you discussed earlier, or as your questions were discussing earlier, there is a two-prong analysis here. The first prong of whether or not the evidence is admissible and whether or not there is a due process violation is whether it's unduly suggestive. Then, if it's determined to be unduly suggestive, the court goes on to those five reliability factors. So in this case, even if it is determined that Agent Tovar's initial meeting and informal conversation with the defendant was considered unduly suggestive because he did know who the defendant was and that he would be taking voice exemplars, the evidence is still admissible and there still is no due process violation because this identification meets basically all of the five bigger factors. The agent had the opportunity to listen to recorded tapes from the time of the 1994 conspiracy for 4 to 6 hours. His attention was focused. He is trained law enforcement. And as trained law enforcement, he knew what is required for a proper identification. And then next, he also had a spontaneous certainty. There was no urgency in his identification. He was not expected to make an identification during this informal conversation. He was expected to make the identification if there was one after listening to the tape. So he didn't need to. His spontaneous certainty is a factor in favor of the reliability. And the other thing is that, of course, there is only a one-day time lapse between him hearing the recorded 1994 conversations and him hearing the defendant's voice. I also want to talk briefly about the prior description element. In this case, there's no need for a prior description. The recordings are the prior description. But I think you can look at the description that Agent Tovar gives later on the stand and take that into account. He says that the defendant's voice was educated, polished, distinct, and that's actually corroborated by a witness who was originally employed by the defendant, Ms. Biedelman, who is a linguist and an interpreter, and she had been asked by the defense to listen to these tape recordings. And when she did, she ultimately determined, albeit not with 100% certainty, that it was, in fact, the defendant's voice on those 1994 tapes. And what she said was she identified his voice in the same way. It was distinct, educated, polished. And so that all corroborates the reliability of Agent Tovar's identification, regardless of the suggestiveness that may have occurred.
You had the confidential informant's ID, Varela's ID.
Yes.
Both his initial ID from the 1997 transaction, and did he also make an ID from the exemplars?
Yes, he did make an ID from the exemplars, and he testified about it.
Okay.
And so that, of course, also corroborates the fact that this was the defendant from the 1994 tapes and provides corroboration. The other thing I do want to point out in regards to the fact that Agent Tovar was the agent who went to go pick up the defendant is that Agent Tovar was asked on redirect about whether or not he was told in any way to make this identification. And what he stated was no one from the government suggested to him in any way that he was to identify the defendant as Fernando and that his identification was based on his own independent opinion. And that's on the appendix 348. And the district court found Agent Tovar to be credible, as he also found Varela to be credible.
But that's not really the relevant inquiry as to suggestiveness. The relevant inquiry is whether he was told that this was Fernando, and he was.
That is true. It is a relevant inquiry in terms of the certainty and the reliability. However, with regard to what Your Honor was discussing with the suggestiveness, I do want to address that further. He was told that this was believed to be Fernando. He did know that going in. However, that's been held up by this court in the past in a case called United States v. DeGlaglia, which I am going to butcher the name a little bit. I believe it's DeGlaglia. In that case, an agent was subpoenaed to trial to make an identification of the defendant when he had previously heard his voice. And he knew that he was being subpoenaed to the trial to give testimony to identify the defendant. And in that case, the Seventh Circuit recognized that there was some level of suggestiveness. It appears that the Seventh Circuit did not even go as far as to say that it was unduly suggestive. Just merely that recognizing that it was suggestive, and then went on to find that because of the circumstances in that situation, that it was a reliable identification, and therefore that evidence should be admissible.
On the Sixth Amendment issue, are you familiar with this Infelice case?
I apologize, Your Honor. I am actually not familiar with that case, although it does seem to discuss this issue of voice exemplars not being a critical stage, but
well,
I do apologize.
Well, also, it involves a set of IDs made, one prior to the giving of voice exemplars by the defendant when the case agent is reading the defendant his rights, and in connection with that, has a face-to-face confrontation with the defendant, listens to his voice, and makes an ID, and then later makes the ID from the voice exemplars. And this court said that's not a Sixth Amendment violation. So, it referred to both aspects of the ID. So it seems like it controls here.
I am not familiar with that, but I do agree with that. And there's also a Sixth Circuit and a Ninth Circuit case that I cited in my brief that also find the same thing, in addition to the Fourth Circuit case that appears to be very similar to this situation. It also is supported by the Gilbert v. California dicta, which talks about the fact that exemplars, including voice, are not critical stages because they don't involve a confrontation. If there's not further questions from the panel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time. You have 1 minute.
I just want to make the point that a voice exemplar was not at issue in this case. This was an identification. It wasn't an exemplar. Counsel is not required for the mere taking of an exemplar, but it is required during an identification, including voice identifications. The 4 to 6 hours of wasn't enough familiarity to overcome the suggestiveness of the procedure here. And it can't be deemed reliable. This is not harmless error. The district court found that Agent Tovar's testimony played a prominent part in the trial, found him to be very firm in his conviction of the voice identification. And without Tovar's voice identification, you're only left with a paid informant and the unsure lay witness. So the counsel was required here. It was unduly suggestive. It was unreliable. And this cannot be deemed harmless error.
Thank you, counsel. And you were appointed in this case?
Yes.
Thank you very much for taking the assignment and representing your client very well.